Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. 25 years ago, a band out of Boston called the Pixies released an album called Doolittle. The title conjured up images of Dr. Doolittle, the children's story about a man who could talk with the animals. And right there on the cover was a monkey, surrounded by the numbers 5, 6, and 7. The numbers referred to what would become a famous and famously inscrutable line from one of that album's best songs. Clearly, this was not aimed at kids. But I'll never forget the first time my older daughter heard this song, Monkey Gone to Heaven. She must have been 8 or 9 years old and already seriously into animal rights, and she heard that line about how man is 5 and the devil is 6 and God is 7, and she said, "The monkey blames the man because he puts him in the lab, and he blames the devil for making the man bad, but he blames God most of all because God lets it happen." Well, I had one of those moments where the hair on the back of your neck stands up. I mean, what could I say to that? A generation of college kids grew up puzzling over that line, and here's this fifth grader coming up with a chillingly plausible explanation. Of course, there are many other ways to approach these songs by the Pixies, and Ben Cesario of the New York Times will be along to look back at the 25-year legacy of this now classic album. And if Doolittle by the Pixies is in your record collection, it may be getting kind of grimy by now, so we'll have a return visit from Jolie Kerr, who writes the Ask a Clean Person blog. She's got more cleaning tips specifically for us music fans. But first, let's hear some live music. The Secret Sisters really are sisters, but Laura and Lydia Rogers are no secret anymore. T-Bone Burnett just produced their new album, their second, and it's getting terrific reviews. And you'll hear why. Here are the Secret Sisters doing If I Don't, live on Soundcheck.
Baby, I see you've been up to nothing good. I got a hunch you would leave me if you could. You only keep me around for the company. I can see the way you like.
make it clear. Am I getting through? Nobody that you need. When you're hunting someone new is gonna stick around the way I always do. I don't think you see what you got when you got me. I'm laying down the rules. This is how it's gotta be. You're gonna change your ways. Or honey, I'm gone.
That's the Secret Sisters here in the Soundcheck studio performing their song, If I Don't. Stick around because they're sticking around. We'll hear more from them later in the show. Now, if you thought that song was catchy... And just like that, you'll have this song stuck in your head for at least the next 3 hours. Here Comes Your Man by the Pixies might be one of the catchiest pop songs ever. It's one of those so-called earworms that just gets stuck in your head. But even more remarkable is the fact that this song is just one of many great tunes on the Pixies album Doolittle, released 25 years ago, April 1989. Joining me to look back at this alternative rock classic is Ben Cesario, music writer for the New York Times, and author of the Doolittle installment of the music book series known as 33 and a Third. Ben, welcome back.
Thanks very much.
So 33 and a Third is, you know, a series of these books about individual records. Why did you choose to write about Doolittle?
Well, for me personally, the whole album is an earworm from the first time I heard it in 1989. You know, I was 14 at the time, and it was, it kind of blew my mind. And it's one of those albums that I never got sick of. I always was fascinated by it, and I loved the music, and I was curious about everything that was going on within it. And I think that historically, it kind of came at an interesting point. And as time went on, it's one of those records that I just find myself sort of going back to and wondering about kind of the story it tells overall.
Well, and where were the Pixies? I mean, tell us where this album fits in the story of this band.
They were from Boston. They started in 85 or 86. This was their second full-length album. Mm-hmm. And the one before this, Surfer Rosa, is another total masterpiece. But this is kind of the breakthrough, if they ever really had a breakthrough.
Yeah.
I think that's debatable. But, you know, this is sort of the one that got them a lot of the interviews in major magazines and so forth.
Although the first record has Gigantic on it.
The first one has Gigantic.
Which is now being reused on a TV commercial these days.
Yeah, by Apple.
By Apple, yes. So, you know, they had some kind of traction, it seems.
They had buzz from the beginning.
Yeah.
But I think that one of the things that you have to remember about that time is that aside from maybe REM or a few other bands, the whole idea of kind of alternative rock or college rock really wasn't a big mainstream commercial phenomenon. There wasn't really that much of the idea that a band like this could sell zillions of
right.
records. It really wasn't until Nirvana came along a couple of years later that happened, and the music industry went crazy over it. And I think we're still kind of feeling the effects of that to some extent now.
And Nirvana, of course. I mean, Kurt Cobain was pretty open about the Pixies
right.
being a major influence. We're talking specifically, though, about the Pixies' album Doolittle, which is now 25 years old. And, you know, if I had to pick one song, just one song from this record to take on a desert island, it would be this one.
There was a guy and the water god who control all the sea. Got killed by 10 million pounds of sludge from New York and New Jersey.
A little bit of the Pixies' song Monkey Gone to Heaven from their album Doolittle. We're speaking with Ben Cesario, music writer of the New York Times, and his book about the Pixies' album Doolittle was published back in 2006 for the series known as 33 and a Third. And, you know, Ben, I heard Here Comes Your Man on the radio. You know, there was WLIR, the old alternative rock station on Long Island, that would occasionally play that. And I was like, okay, fun song. That song, Monkey Gone to Heaven, was the one that made me think, okay, now I need to, like, find out who this is and what else they've done.
I think a lot of people have that reaction either to Monkey Gone to Heaven or maybe another one on the record, too, like Debaser.
Debaser,
the first song,
yeah,
was the one that really made me go, like, whoa, who are these guys? All this slicing up eyeballs kind of stuff. But Monkey Gone to Heaven is a great place to start talking about it because it has a lot of what made them special and what made this record special, which is I think it's got that really sort of tight, almost bubblegum, you know, sweet tunefulness about it. But it also has this really mysterious kind of horror movie side of it of, you know, what is going on here? What is all this? Man is five, devil is six, God is seven. You know, it also has some silly comedy that, mm-hmm, I think is not so silly that it doesn't stand up like the, you know, 10 million pounds of sludge from New York and New Jersey. So I think that there's a lot that kind of gets stuck on you, and that the more you listen to it and think about it, it kind of adds on itself and it doesn't wear off. I mean, I think they're not really gimmicks. I think that they're pretty deep sides to a whole aesthetic approach about what they're trying to do.
And I think part of the point here is that when Doolittle was released by the Pixies, it wasn't like immediately hailed as, you know, a masterpiece that we'd still be talking about 25
Not
years
at
later.
All.
It was kind of a slow burn as people had these reactions that we're talking about.
It hit number 98 on the Billboard chart. That was its peak.
Yeah.
I mean, they were a pretty classic kind of critics darling. But the story of the Pixies and of this record, too, is, you know, they broke up in 93, at the beginning of 93. And over the rest of the 90s and into the 2000s, there was just this mythology that built. And Kurt Cobain saying that he was just trying to rip them off with the loud, quiet dynamics and stuff, that kind of added to a legend about,
yeah,
sort of who they were, that they're sort of the ones that came right before the flood. And that, you know, Cobain and Tom York and various other people, you know, David Bowie has been talking about, mm-hmm, it forever. You know, TV on the radio more recently were huge fans. So there's just kind of been this steady buzz of conversation among people that everybody respects.
So it's this kind of musical Rosetta Stone that
the
mythology has just grown over the past 25 years. The album is Doolittle by the Pixies. And we asked some of our Soundcheck listeners where they were in 1989 when the record was released and whether they were fans. Ebhead tweeted us, "Saw them open for The Cure at Giant Stadium with Love and Rockets that year, as well as a show at the New Ritz on 54th. And Anne tweeted that in 1989 she was in my first year of grad school. My boyfriend liked them, but they were intimidating to me. I was just an inch too uncool."
Whoa.
There was something. I mean, you know, you take a song like Wave of Mutilation, which, you know, from the title to the subject matter could be sort of off-putting to people who are used to growing up on pop songs about,
yeah,
I love you and you love me, or I love you and you don't love me, or however it works.
I mean, for me, you know, at that time, I couldn't have felt more uncool, but that's one of the things that attracted me to them is that they just kind of look like ordinary folks, and you know they didn't dress crazy. They didn't act crazy. Kind of like the Talking Heads, where their persona was sort of like, we just walked off the street and we're right. normal people, and we just happened to make really amazing music.
Yeah.
And the fact that there was a woman in the band,
Kim Deal,
right, who wasn't a sex toy and wasn't a symbol of something sexy or wild or something, but that almost made her more intriguing. That she was beautiful and she had this amazing voice. And she contributed something very strong to the group.
Yeah.
To me, I mean, that was really interesting, and I didn't feel like they were too cool for school.
Pixies from their now 25-year-old record Doolittle, which is the subject of Ben Cesario's contribution to the 33 and a Third series, a collection of books about individual records. Ben's book about Doolittle was published back in 2006, and he is a music writer for the New York Times, and with us here in the Soundcheck studio today, looking back at the album Doolittle, which includes that song Wave of Mutilation. What do you make of the title? Was that ever fully explained where Doolittle comes from?
It's in the lyrics to one of the songs, and I think it sort of comes from, you know, Dr. Doolittle talking to the animals. But I also think I think one of the ways that Charles Thompson, who's variously known as Black Francis or Frank Black, writes songs is that he comes across something that kind of sparks his imagination and plays with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the origin, you know, maybe it's still there after the, you know, maybe it still winds up being part of the story. Maybe it doesn't. I like the idea that there's this animal nature that kind of comes burning through a lot of this, whether it's Monkey Gone to Heaven or whether it's he's talking about, creatures under the sea in Wave of Mutilation and sort of hanging out down there. And then there's also these kind of biblical scenes of destruction, and one of his big inspirations is surrealism.
Well, now, you mentioned the song Debaser before, which mm-hmm. is track one from Doolittle, and that the surrealism is absolutely front and center here.
It's wearing it on his sleeve. I mean, he's kind of – I feel like it's almost a sort of college sophomore kind of a move to say, hey, you know, I really love this surrealistic film from 1929, and I'm going to write a song about it.
Right. The film, of course, is Un Chien Andalou,
right,
by Luis Buñuel, which famously features an edit where a cloud is sort of moving across the moon, and then it cuts to a razor slicing open an eyeball, which...
Well, it's a man holding a razor blade over a woman's eye, and then it cuts to a cloud going across the moon in just
right.
the same position. So, you know, to give the illusion of
right.
You know, an eyeball being sliced. The movie has a lot of those sort of horror scenes,
yep.
but that are also kind of wacky. I mean, they're funny. If you watch that film, they're a little jarring. They're a little silly. They're a little deep. You know, there's some kind of religious echoes in there also. But, I mean, to me, it really works as a sort of root of what Doolittle is all about, in that it's also just having fun mm-hmm. with a lot of these wacky images.
So listen to how Un Chien Andalou gets twisted both musically and lyrically in this song by the Pixies called Debaser.
Debaser.
That is the striking opening cut, Debaser, from the Pixies' album Doolittle. Now 25 years old, Ben Cesario of the New York Times is with us on Soundcheck, looking back at the record. And that song really encapsulates a lot of what has been so amazing about the Pixies, the combination of noise and pop instinct,
mm-hmm.
and kind of turning this still at the time fairly obscure, although it was famous in film circles, the Buñuel movie, mm-hmm. on Chien Andalou, turning that into a kind of sing-along chorus.
Right.
It's just genius.
And you have, you have Black Francis screaming, and you can sort of hear the roughage in his throat, and then you have that beautiful angelic voice of Kim Deal alongside of it. Just two really simple elements that, they work. I mean, for me, 25 years later, it's beautiful to hear that, and I love hearing it over and over again.
Although we're not going to hear that in the current edition of the Pixies. So when you wrote the book on Doolittle in 2006, they'd already reunited. That happened in 2004. It seemed like, maybe an unhappy reunion from day one. Was that the impression you'd gotten?
I wouldn't call it unhappy, but it definitely seemed like business. There weren't a lot of big hugs.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that they enjoyed playing together on stage. When I saw them in 2004, I remember going into it with a lot of mixed feelings because on the one hand, they were my favorite band and I wanted to see them play. On the other, I didn't want the memory to be tarnished. I didn't want it to stink.
Mm-hmm.
But I was just amazed when they started to play, and I thought, wow, it sounds like the Pixies.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome back. This is cool.
But the personal friction between Kim Deal and Black Francis
never stopped, never ended. And so, they toured the world, and then they toured the world again, and then they toured the world again after that. Eventually they started to say, we need some more gas in the engine here if we're going to keep this going. And so they recorded new music. And they just released it as a full album last week.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Indie Cindy.
The tone of your voice, I'm almost afraid to ask, but how is it?
It's not great. It's not. And I kind of wanted to hate the record, and there's a lot of it that I don't like.
Yeah.
I will say, though, that there's quite a few things in it that I'm surprised that I do kind of like, and that, they do kind of still get into my head. I like the song Indie Cindy. I like the song Magdalena 318. But listening to it, I have the same feeling that I think a lot of people do, which is this really the Pixies?
Right.
Kim is not playing on it. Mm-hmm. Not only is Kim not playing on it, but they've been through a couple bass players since. So is this still the band that I love, or is this some kind of animatronic, reconstitution of it?
Well, let's hear the song Magdalena 318 from the new Pixies album called Indie Cindy. That's the Pixies as they are currently constituted. Magdalena 318 is a song from the new album called Indie Cindy. And as Ben Cesario was just asking the question, the big question in the minds of Pixies fans is this the Pixies if Kim Deal is not in the band? It's a fair question. Joey Santiago's still in the band, still sounds great on guitar. And, of course,
David Lovering's on the drums. Charles Thompson, Black Francis, is still singing. But that's 3/4 of a whole, I think, the way lots of people look at it. And I feel, especially that particular song, I just miss Kim in there.
Yeah.
I want to hear her voice. I want to hear her contribution.
Well, back in the day, you know, there were a series of great records made by this band, and the one we've been focusing on is Doolittle, which is now 25 years old, the subject of Ben's contribution in the 33 and a Third series, Doolittle, published in 2006 by Ben Cesario. And Soundcheck listeners, we want you to take our Doolittle challenge. Summarize the album in 6 words or less, and then tweet us at Soundcheck, or post your 6-word summary at soundcheck.org. Ebhead went with the little musical cosmology that appeared on dorm rooms all over the country: Man 5, Devil 6, God 7.
There you go.
All right, from Monkey Gone to Heaven. Sebastian writes, epic, nostalgic, fresh, influential, dark, groundbreaking. All of which are true. But I like this one from Anne. Prickly punk shell, creamy pop filling.
I like that, too.
That seems to fit. So a final question, Ben. Doolittle, now 25 years old, how has it aged?
I think it's aged beautifully. I think unlike a lot of records from that time, and I was thinking of a lot of other records like right on the brink of the kind of alternative rock explosion, like Jane's Addiction is another one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that one has aged terribly well. But I think that this, and I'm a biased person here because I, you know, I've loved the record forever. But I think it ages really well because I think that the songs and the production by Gil Norton are very, very tight. And I also think that his approach to writing songs, where he'll sort of take these a little element of sex and death and God and some surrealistic inspiration and kind of stitch it all together. It means that it's not topical and it's timeless, and it, to me, it's still kind of a puzzle that it's fun to listen to and to try to solve.
And the loud and the dynamic of loud and quiet, light and dark. I mean, that is timeless too, and you know, is now a big part of indie rock, alternative rock, whatever we're calling it. As we hear in this song called Tame from the album Doolittle. We've been speaking with Ben Cesario, music writer for The New York Times. His book about Doolittle for the 33 and a Third series was published some years ago, 2006. It is still out there, and so are the Pixies. Ben, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Are you up for Soundcheck's Doolittle Challenge? Summarize the album Doolittle by the Pixies in 6 words or less. Then tweet us at Soundcheck or post your 6-word commentary on soundcheck.org. Or leave us a voicemail, 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612. Up next, Jolie Kerr of the blog Ask a Clean Person returns with more ways to keep the world of music just a bit tidier. And later, live music from the country folk duo, The Secret Sisters. This is Soundcheck.
I'll polish the leaves, make them green again, shake out the trees, change scene again, spring cleaning, getting ready for love.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. A couple of days ago, we got a visit, a desperately needed visit, from Jolie Kerr, creator of the Ask a Clean Person column for websites like Deadspin and Jezebel. Jolie is also the author of the book My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. It is, after all, spring cleaning season, and that can be a particularly perilous time for music fans. Jolie, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks for having me back.
You left us with some tips for cleaning stuff off of your shoes if you're at a music festival and, you know, beer or whatever gets spilled on those. You talked about using an old T-shirt to kind of, you know, rub out the... And that gets us to a question that many music fans will have, which is, how do you deal with those old concert T-shirts that you've kept for 20 years and they mean a lot to you, but you want to save it from becoming a schmata, you know, a rag.
Exactly. Well, yeah, when they start getting those holes. And that's, of course, the point at which the T-shirt becomes perfect, because it's perfectly soft and it feels so great. That is the point at which you probably, if you can stand to do this, you probably want to stop machine washing it and take to hand washing it. Now, people hear that and they're like, I don't have time for hand washing. This is not a thing that takes any time. We're really talking about a 5-minute process here. And you can, of course, sort of wait until you've got a couple of your threadbare T-shirts that need washing, do them all at once. It's not going to take all that much time. Best thing to do for hand washing, kitchen sink, make sure the dishes are not in it before you start this process. Just plug it up, fill it with lukewarm water, a tiny bit of detergent. You really do not need a lot of detergent at all. People always over-detergent. I'm guilty of it too. But just really a tiny bit. Put the shirts in, let them soak for, you know, just a couple minutes. Go in, drain the water, rinse them out. When you're talking about a really threadbare T-shirt, don't rinse them under the running water, because that's going to really distress the fibers. Instead, what to do when they're really, really threadbare is just refill the sink with clean water and rinse them by soaking them in sort of a you know, pool of clean water rather than directly under the faucet.
Okay.
Then just roll them up in a towel to squeeze dry, lay flat, and they'll dry. Don't hang them. Because, again, they're threadbare and they're wet, which means they're heavy and they're going to start pulling down and really stress those fibers again. So you want to lay them flat. But, you know, the thing is that we're talking about fairly thin cotton shirts.
Yeah.
They're going to get pretty dry just from rolling them up in the towel. And I do recommend people roll them in the towel. Do not wring them, because, again, that's another thing that's going to stress the fiber.
So if you want that 1978 Ramones concert T-shirt to pass on to your kids.
Yeah, you're going to have to show it a little love.
Okay.
Now, if you absolutely, or if you're listening to this and you're like, lady, come on. There's no way I'm hand washing my laundry. I'm too metal for that, you know. Then machine wash, use a delicate cycle, and use one of those mesh lingerie bags. Put them in. If you have the kind of washing machine that's a top loader with a center agitator, just be really, really, really careful. Maybe use a couple of extra towels in there to buffer that center agitator. That's really going to cause a lot of tearing. The full drum machines, like the front loaders, the HEs, and the top loaders that don't have an agitator are going to be a little bit more gentle. But same kind of thing. Don't use a ton of detergent. Don't use bleaches. Those are harsh.
Mm-hmm. All right. Music-related cleaning questions, you can leave them on our website, soundcheck.org, or call us up, 866-939-1612. Leave a voicemail, 866-939-1612. It is spring cleaning season, which poses some specific problems for music fans. What about, you know, CDs, you know, you love them, you play them over the years, they will inevitably get grimy, you know, no matter how careful you are, someone will come along and, oh, look at this great CD, and leave a fingerprint. Maybe you're throwing a party and a little beer or wine gets spilled. What do you do for CDs?
Sure thing. So CDs, you can either buy CD cleaner, which, you know, they sell at most music stores. That's fine. Also, just a microfiber cloth is good for dusting, fingerprints, stuff like that. You actually won't really even need a special cleaner for stuff like that. What you don't want to use with CDs is anything that's paper. Even really fine, soft paper can lead to scratching. The same is true of glass, like eyeglasses. So be careful about your use of paper products on scratchable surfaces. Better to stick with microfiber for that one, anything that can scratch.
All right. And stereo components with the grills in the back, you want to vacuum that dust out of there?
Yeah, you can. You certainly can vacuum. Microfiber.
I'm not going to if you answer me like that.
Well, you don't necessarily have to.
Okay. That's what I wanted to hear.
Yeah, you don't necessarily have to vacuum. You know, from time to time, like maybe every couple years, you might actually want to just go over with a brush attachment, you know, keep the lifespan of these things,
mm-hmm.
you know. But really, microfiber is gonna go a long way in cleaning those stereo components.
We're speaking with Jolie Kerr, the creator of Ask a Clean Person, a column for websites like Deadspin and Jezebel. Her book is My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. In your book, one of my favorite lines is you talk about put on some music. This is crucial to the process in that it will help to keep you from killing yourself as you go about your cleaning business. So what do you listen to when you clean?
I listen to, well, sort of whatever mood I'm in. So I don't really have a set playlist for cleaning, which people oftentimes think I do. But I really tend to like a lot of 70s sort of soft rock. I call it fern bar music. Fern bar music.
Fern bar.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I actually used to write a column about fern bar music and drinks.
Kind of upscale, yuppie singles bar places.
Exactly. The Chablis and Brie kind of crowd from the late 70s and 80s.
Okay.
You know, Seals and Crofts, Michael McDonald type music is really my big jam. But I also, you know, I went to high school and college in the 90s. So sometimes if I'm feeling angsty, I will, you know, go back and put on my old, you know, Smashing Pumpkins kind of stuff and you know, sometimes pull out my old flight jacket from storage, pretend like I'm, you know, 21 again.
Jolie Kerr is with us on Soundcheck. Her book's called My Boyfriend Barfed in My Handbag and Other Things You Can't Ask Martha. It is out now, and she also has her column, Ask a Clean Person, on Deadspin and Jezebel, and she's been with us on Soundcheck once again today with music-related cleaning tips. Jolie, happy spring cleaning.
Thank you.
Still to come, another in-studio performance from the Secret Sisters, playing songs from their new album produced by T-Bone Burnett. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Laura and Lydia Rogers grew up in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, a city that musicians have flocked to for decades to write and record some of their most soulful music. But the sisters didn't get their start in any of their hometown's famous studios. They began singing together at church. Years later, they were discovered at a Nashville audition and became known as the Secret Sisters. Now they've just released their second album, produced by T-Bone Burnett. It's called Put Your Needle Down, and the Secret Sisters are here with me in the Soundcheck studio today, and they're going to start us off with their song called I Cannot Find a Way.
Telling me to try again. I cannot find.
That's some nice singing.
Oh, thank you.
Secret Sisters, live on Soundcheck with I Cannot Find a Way. Laura Rogers, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And Lydia Rogers, good to have you here as well.
Good to be here.
Lydia was also playing the acoustic guitar, Jesse Acock playing electric guitar, and Patrick Ryan playing a whole bunch of percussion here in the Soundcheck studio. So that's from the new album called Put Your Needle Down. I mentioned in the introduction that you guys started singing together in church, but that's not a very churchy kind of sound that you have there.
No, it's not. Our sound, I guess, as of this moment in time, has really evolved a good bit. I mean, when we first kind of were discovered at the audition that you mentioned in the intro, you know, we're very rooted in classic country and gospel and bluegrass music. That's kind of where we feel most familiar and at home. But then with this record, we kind of wanted it to expand past those boundaries a little bit. We just love kind of that early pop rock sound.
Yeah.
And we just find ourselves gravitating towards that in everything that we do. So we were able to kind of capture that a little bit better with this most recent record.
Now, you guys are from Muscle Shoals, Alabama, which is just, you know, rich. Have you guys seen the documentary?
We have.
Yeah.
We're big fans.
I mean, it just makes... I've never been to Muscle Shoals, but, you know, the shots of the Tennessee River there just makes it look like God's green earth or something.
is
that really
gorgeous.
What it's like?
It's gorgeous down there.
Yeah.
It's a little – I think that people are a little surprised when they visit Muscle Shoals because they expect it to be this booming metropolis, and it isn't at all. It's just a tiny little southern –
You have to dig a little deeper to see what's valuable about it.
Yeah.
Did you guys grow up aware of all the music history that had been made right there in your hometown?
I mean, we were aware of it. Our dad, of course, was very in tune to all of that kind of music history that we're known for in that part of the state. But growing up, we never really...
Is your dad a musician?
He is
a musician, yeah. So he was kind of responsible for guiding us along in our music knowledge. And he would always talk about Muscle Shoals and how special it was. But when you're a kid, you just don't... You don't grasp the magnitude of it. And then I really don't even think until recently, when the documentary came out, did we really realize how... important, you know, that history is. So,
well, now, as we speak, as we're recording this, Muscle Shoals and the rest of the South are under a kind of severe tornado warning. And yesterday, you know, big swath of them, big picture on the cover of the New York Times today of the devastation.
Mm-hmm, right.
You guys actually wrote a song for the Hunger Games that was inspired by a tornado outbreak in the South, right?
It was. We wrote it about, I guess it was 3 years, 2 days ago. We were actually in Australia at the time, and it was when all these terrible tornadoes came through, and we were both really hurting and sad that we couldn't be there, and so we were inspired to write a song about it.
And so it was written not for specifically for the Hunger Games?
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. But they heard it and...
It's so hard to be away, you know, even today, knowing all the kind of chaos that's going on down there. We keep seeing pictures coming in, and it's hard, you know, as a Southerner, especially feeling so rooted to your geography, it's hard to kind of be away and watch all the news coming in. But that's what music, it heals in a lot of ways.
Did that work for you 3 years ago when you wrote this song, Tomorrow Will Be Kinder?
I think it did. I mean, I don't know that it necessarily healed us because we were not directly affected, but it did kind of help to document those emotions that we felt. And eventually, I think that song came to mean so much more than just about, you know, a movie that it was a part of or that one specific terrible day. It became a little bigger than that. So now anytime we feel sad, we think about that, you know, the whole point of that song.
Well, let's hear a little bit of that song. It's from the Hunger Games soundtrack, from the Secret Sisters, Laura and Lydia Rogers.
Black clouds are behind me. I now can see ahead. Often I wonder why I try, hoping for an end. Sorrow weighs my shoulders down, and trouble haunts my mind. But I know the present will not last, and tomorrow will be kind. guess tomorrow will be kinder.
Tomorrow Will Be Kinder, written by Laura and Lydia Rogers. They are the Secret Sisters, and that's their contribution to the soundtrack to the film Hunger Games. Although inspired originally by a 2011 tornado outbreak in their native Alabama. And so, Lydia, that's you solo first.
That's me, yeah.
But man, the sound just changes dramatically when Laura's voice comes in. Those sibling harmonies, I mean, you know, whether you're talking about sisters or brothers or whatever, there's something magical about that. I mean, did you guys always sing together growing up?
I think we did it a lot in the privacy of our own home and at family reunions, but other than that, we never sang together. Laura was a little shy on the stage, but I always liked to sing at 4-H competitions.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we didn't really sing together until we were discovered and signed.
Right. And then Laura seems to have overcome the shyness
yes.
in a big way.
It's amazing when you throw someone in the water, they have to learn how to swim or they'll drown.
So what do you get, Laura, out of singing with Lydia that's different if you were singing with someone who is not close relative?
Well, I mean, it's always interesting just kind of like off stage, the kind of disagreements that we get into. I wouldn't have that with anybody else because somehow I don't have a filter with my sister. But I think that one of the best things
about
says
Lydia. no filter.
Course, there comes her interjection. I think just, you know, in those moments when you're away from home and you feel vulnerable or sad or homesick, you have someone who's right there with you who understands it. And just the fact that, you know, we come from such identical backgrounds. We've got the same, you know, parents and home. And it's just like she just gets me in a way that nobody else does. And sometimes that's a wonderful thing and sometimes it's bad.
So when you're putting these harmonies together, is it intuitive or are you actually like writing down intervals? You know,
oh,
I want you on the third here. And yeah,
maybe we should sometimes, but we never practice. We just do what we do. And
it's
very
unscientific.
Bad,
we're not very professionally or classically skilled in that area. So.
But, you know, a lot of the great, I mean, from the Carter family on, there's a long tradition of, you know, families making great music
right.
without writing it down or, necessarily knowing what they're singing.
Sure.
The album's called Put Your Needle Down, the latest from the Secret Sisters. We're hearing all the songs you're doing for us are songs you guys have written.
Mm-hmm, correct.
This next one, co-written with Gordy Sampson, it was used in the ABC TV series Nashville.
Right,
it was.
It's called Let There Be Lonely. Let's hear a live performance.
Yeah.
The Secret Sisters, live on Soundcheck with Let There Be Lonely. It appears on their latest album called Put Your Needle Down. The Secret Sisters are Laura and Lydia Rogers. And this album, I mean, Laura, you mentioned before kind of the early rock and roll sound that you guys went for this time around. There, I mean, it's not like music ended when the Beatles hit America, though, because there's a cover on this album of a P.J. Harvey song.
Indeed.
A fairly obscure P.J. Harvey song, Pocket Knife, although, you know, it's kind of a murder ballad, isn't it?
Sure, Definitely. Yeah. In a lot of ways, in a lot of different ways, I guess. We actually did not know that song. We had never heard it, and we're not very familiar with P.J. Harvey's catalog. But when we were in the studio, T-Bone, of course, and
T-Bone
all of his
Burnett.
Genius, mm-hmm. he came in and he said, you know, I really feel strongly that you girls should do a cover of somebody who's, like, current and, you know, very reputable in the music world. And he just kind of pulled that out of his pocket and said, hey, have you heard this song? And at first we were like, oh, this is so different. Like, we're used to doing covers of, like, Patsy Cline and the Everly Brothers, and now here comes P.J. Harvey talking about weapons, you know. And so it was a little left of center for us, but it became really, it feels like a song that we would write, I guess, in a lot of ways. We're proud of it.
There is also an Everly Brothers cover on the record.
That's true.
You know, so, which seems to be, you know, the ubiquitous. Are you getting sick of the Everly Brothers comparison?
No, we never get tired of that. That was actually an accident, that Everly Brothers cover. We both had vowed from the very beginning to never put an Everly's cover on our record.
Because, why?
Because so many people compare us to them. And we were
so
like,
you are getting sick of the comparison.
Well, no. It was more just that we didn't want to kind of do the obvious and
right,
be too,
right.
I guess, intentional about it. But we actually were in the studio and we were taking a break from recording and we had a show back home the next day that we were going to have to fly home for. And we thought, well, during this break, we'll go record or just rehearse a few songs in the stairwell. So we sneak off by ourselves into a stairwell at the studio and we play this Everly Brothers song that we love singing. And all of a sudden when we finish, T-Bone peeps around the corner and we didn't know he had been listening. And he goes, I'm sorry, girls, but we have to record that song. We're like, oh, shoot, what have we done? But we love that song. So it was okay in the end.
The song is Lonely Island,
yes.
which we'll hear a little bit of to say goodbye. But let me first properly say goodbye. Laura, Lydia, to you and the boys, thank you for coming in and playing
for
us
for
today. It's been a lot of fun.
Them. Very fun.
The Secret Sisters, the new album is called Put Your Needle Down. This is Soundcheck.
I'm living on a lonely island in a loveless ocean full of misery. I'll die.
That's the Secret Sisters doing their version of a song made famous by the Everly Brothers called Lonely Island. And that comes from the Secret Sisters' new record, Put Your Needle Down. Tomorrow on the show, a look at the contenders in this year's Eurovision Song Contest. Plus, 100 years ago this month, the Marx Brothers took on their famous stage names. We'll hear about the music that accompanied their legendary shtick and live music from the British art rock band These New Puritans. All of that is tomorrow. That does it for today. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.